Before we get started, I want to let you know that the DVD of my new documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available. Go to my website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page, and it'll lead you to PayPal, where you can order a copy or 10 copies. I urge you to do the latter. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, sometimes known as the Weenie King, by which I mean cold are the hands of time that creep along relentlessly, destroying slowly but without pity that which yesterday was young. Alone our memories resist this disintegration and grow more lovely with the passing years. That's hard to say even without false teeth. Take it from me. Got a good show for you tonight. My good friend John Tibbetts is my guest. I have known John since the dawn of time. In fact, I owe my entire career to John Tibbetts, such as it is. And as a matter of fact, sometimes I harbor cold, hard blame for him because of the way things have turned out. But John published my very first articles in his magazine, American Classic Screen. He was part of a group called the National Film Society. I met him when I was a mere pup and was already interested in writing a book about William Wellman, but had no idea about how to do so. And so he gave me a break and let me write a couple of articles for his magazine on Wellman. And that was the beginning of the start of the beginning. And I have known him ever since. We've had a lot of great adventures together and many, many, many great conversations. John is one of these guys that I just get tired thinking about. I'm not unprolific as a writer. I've written quite a few books and articles and so forth. But John puts me to shame. It just is astonishing the number of books that he's written or edited, or co-written, and the number of articles that he's written, if you gathered them together, their numbers would blot out the sun. He's also done hundreds of video interviews with not only movie stars and directors and producers and writers, but also a vast number of classical music people, pianists, composers, conductors, you name it. John knows a whole lot about a whole lot of things. And he and I share a great many interests. And so whenever he's around, we sit around and talk for hours on end. And so in this case, we had microphones turned on. And we talk about the early days of the National Film Society and some of the adventures we had at those conventions and at those awards dinners and the wonderful stars we met and the very peculiar actions we saw happen there. And we also talk about a lot of things, and it just goes on and on, and I had a wonderful time. As a matter of fact, we had such a good time that as soon as we finished, we shook it off, walked around a little bit, got something to drink, walked out in the backyard, took in a good lungful of fresh air, came back into my house and did another one. So this will be followed up next week by part two of my interview with John Tibbetts. And you will find out some interesting things about him and about me and about our lives as film historians and as devotees of literature and music and all sorts of things that we share, and mostly about movies, because this is, after all, a movie podcast. So enjoy this talk with John Tibbetts, and I'll see you on the other side. Okay. Let's test history here and see if you remember how we met.
Okay. Well, I remember I was at a desk at the Command Central of the National Film Society's magazine, American Classic Screen, and every day there would be correspondence coming in. Unsolicited manuscripts, letters of inquiry, etc. This would have been at 83rd and Mission Road in Kansas City, more properly Overland Park, 1976, 7, maybe a year or two later, because I think the publication of your first story was 1980. So a little later than 76 or 7. And there was this article about William Wellman. I think it was either the Westerns or the Paramount years. Might have been the Paramount years. And I was so struck by the fact that I'm actually looking at an article about something and about a filmmaker I've heard of and an article that has substance and an article that's well written. And after having already spent a couple of years really looking at, you know, my years with the Three Stooges type article, suddenly here's an article on William Wellman. So I think I contacted you by letter, and I remember some astonishment on your part that maybe somebody cared, although surely that couldn't have been. I'm more interested in asking you how you came to write and send an article to American Classic Screen in the first place. I don't know that I've ever asked you that.
Well, we should remake Rashomon because that is exactly not how it happened.
Uh-huh.
We met, I was living in Chicago.
This is interesting.
And you guys came to Chicago to do a conference on the Western and the gangster film.
We called it Men with Guns.
Exactly. And I attended simply because it was a film conference, and I figured I would see the films and listen to the lectures, and it all seemed like something that would be up my alley.
I think Joel Siegel was there.
And among the films you played were The Public Enemy.
Yeah.
Was The Public Enemy. And you also showed The Shootist, I recall that. And I forget what else. Junior Bonner, I believe, was shown over the course of that conference. And so you and I and Jim Welsh started talking. I told you that I was interested in Wellman, and we were doing some, and we started talking, and we went out to dinner one night with Gene Phillips.
Yeah.
And it was after that that you asked me to write an article about Wellman. So I did not submit an article about Wellman at all.
I'm mythologizing this already.
Yeah.
The idea that an article comes unsolicited out of the sky seems so much more interesting to me.
Wouldn't it be?
Wow.
And because of the conference, you're the one who suggested, why don't you do one on Wellman's Westerns? Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. So,
I think at that time I knew Robin Hood of El Dorado. And let's see, what other Western of his had I seen? Because not so many of them, you know, were around.
You must have seen Oxbow Incident.
And Oxbow, of course. And I'd read the novel and always been very impressed by the whole saga of novel to screen in that event. So, well, at any rate, to receive something in the mail like that was great. And you ended up doing two. It was kind of a part two, the Paramount years and the Westerns. And the Paramount years was especially interesting because I think that took Wellman up to 1930. And so you're really dealing with some titles there, some of which I still have yet to see.
Yeah.
And that was great.
If I hadn't seen those films when I was writing that article, and that would be 1979, I guess, I was living in Chicago. There was a local 16mm distributor, and it was Universal 16, I guess, and they had 16mm prints of these incredibly rare. They said, the guy I talked to said, nobody has ever rented these, and I think they rented them to me for $20 a piece or something.
Well, Universal 16 had Fleming's The Virginian, too.
Yeah.
And I booked that several times, and ever since, I have yet to find it anywhere.
Yeah. But these films, Dangerous Paradise, Young Eagles, Woman Trap, The Man I Love, they're just Chinatown Nights. They're incredibly rare. They've never been on TV that I'm aware of.
I'm beginning to wonder if it was maybe the first time in print there were even discussions of those titles.
Yeah.
Every once in a while it occurs to me that American Classic Screen might actually have contributed something to the literature, certainly in terms of the people we encountered.
American Classic Screen from the time that I first encountered it, which would have been then, I guess, always struck me as being a real step above what else was going on. Because there was, the other things were mostly just fan writing, and there was some of that in American Classic Screen, but mostly it was people who were really trying to do some legitimate research and write about interesting subjects.
There was always that kind of tightrope balancing act between a fanish enthusiasm and hopefully trying to get some substantial rigor to the material as well. I remember Greg Black, a colleague of mine, he was at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, had called my attention to an ad Randolph Neal had placed about the magazine and the society. And so Greg and I went to see Randy, and all I had to do was say, gee, I can paint. Would you like me to paint one of your covers? And that first one was Ginger Rogers. And you know, Frank, it's occurred to me over and over and over again, as much as I like to write and hopefully can be proud of it, more often than not, it's been the artwork that has opened doors, maybe closed a few, I don't know. But certainly in the case of American Classic Screen, that was my entree into the magazine. And you, of course, then became involved in the National Film Society. I even remember you playing the piano for the Ten Commandments, I think, at one of our expos.
That was at the Salisbury. It was a conference at Salisbury State.
Was that? I think that may have been where we also first showed Picnic at Hanging Rock, which changed my life.
It could be.
Soldier of Orange.
I brought up Wellman's Roxy Hart to show.
Mm-hmm.
And this has always stuck in my mind because we're at this, it was kind of an academic conference, and it wasn't too onerous for being that, but there were a lot of papers being read and that sort of thing that were all that academic kind of stuff. And I showed Roxy Hart to a very enthusiastic response. And then afterwards, when we were doing a Q&A, I did a little intro for it, and then we did some discussion afterwards. And somebody in the audience said, well, that was fun, but my question is, why in the world would anybody make a movie like this? I said, sometimes, like what?
Academics are more foolish than the fans.
Yeah, and I think her point was, why would you make a movie just for fun or just to be entertaining?
Wow.
It didn't make any sense to her at all. I thought, wow, I'm in the wrong place here.
Well, that was exactly the kind of thing that one got immediately a sense of from you. There was always this almost boyish enthusiasm about things and the acceptance that fun had its own values and need not look for anything else to justify it. Although, in a movie like that, you can certainly continue on and find beneath the fun all kinds of things. But the fun part, the surface, the enthusiasm, that's something that the fans always, at the very least, do bring to these things. You turned out to be an unusual example of that fanish enthusiasm, but also a willingness to devote your entire life to lost causes.
Yep.
You and I were talking the other day, and it struck me that we need to form a royal order of last stands and lost causes. And I think it's a very noble organization, because who else would pursue those things? And they need to be pursued. And when you look at the myth-making that goes on, of which you and I are fans of, we were just talking about Custer, the Alamo, the Titanic, the Foreign Legion. Where would we be without lost causes and last stands? These are ultimately the most important things.
Yeah, it's the I would just as soon have not gotten into that part of my life where lost causes are all I go after. I would like a paycheck now and again.
Don't you think, though, that there's a secret fascination for those things because they're unfinished? Because they draw you onward, because a kind of closure may never happen, which is great. You don't want it to happen. Just like you said, you don't want to know the secret of a magic trick either. That ongoing thing that draws you on, quite against your own reason and common sense. Mm. But that's the appeal. And Frank, somebody's got to do it.
I guess somebody. Yeah. But why me?
And the Film Society and the American Classic Screen, in their own way, were lost causes. All of that came too soon. We were just on the edge of the video revolution. Now Turner Classic Movies cashes in on these gatherings of celebrities and fans and the proliferation of films in all different kinds of media. But in 1976, there was such a limitation on that. And so it was pursuing a kind of foolish dream to think that we could do that. But on the other hand, a Kansas City-based organization to accomplish what we did in 8 or 9 years, I'd have to say, on balance, pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And those conventions out of the, usually at the Sheraton Universal,
mm-hmm.
but the banquets that you had really had some powerhouse people there. I mean, we were talking yesterday about the time that Step and Fetch It was there and got an award, and he was wheeled up in his wheelchair, and he got out of the wheelchair and started to dance.
There was a little bit of apprehension about that whole award nomination and presentation, but no problem. It brought down the house.
Yeah.
I remember a visit to the Motion Picture Country Home, meeting DeWitt Bodine, and the gentleman who wrote My Adventures with D.W. Griffith.
Carl Brown.
And Carl Brown
yeah.
was still there, still alive.
You and I went out and visited Carl, and mm-hmm. That was quite a shock to me. For those who don't know, Carl was D.W. Griffith, one of D.W. Yeah. Griffith's cameramen, and then directed his own films, including a terrific movie made in North Carolina in 1927 called Stark Love.
Right.
And when I was living in Atlanta, I wrote to Carl, having never met him, but Kevin Brownlow gave me his address, and I said, I'm going up to Asheville, North Carolina, and I would be real interested in visiting some of the locations that you used for Stark Love. And he wrote back, I believe, a 3-page, single-space typed letter that told me all about how they did mm-hmm. the film and where they went and all this. And then the last sentence was, but you can't find any of this today because the Tennessee Valley Authority flooded it all when they did dams. So none of it is there. But he did mention the Grove Park Inn, where they stayed, and he said, if it's still there, you should go because it's remarkable. And, in fact, I did go there, and it is remarkable, and it's still there, and it's a hotel like nothing you've ever seen in your life.
But all of this points up the fact that things were disappearing rapidly, day by day.
Yeah.
People were dying. The people we managed to track down and talk with, that was the thing about the National Film Society and the American Classic Screen, was it was an excuse
yeah.
to go track down these people, visits to Pickfair. I remember, I loved the time we spent with Richard Farnsworth.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
that was in Burbank. And dining with him and interviewing him. And
except I humiliated myself then. Do you
yeah,
remember
you have
that?
To tell that story.
we were sitting, it's kind of a horseshoe-shaped booth, and Farnsworth was at the business end of it. And I was in a chair in the aisle, basically. And so everybody else was formed around in this horseshoe shape. But I was face-to-face with Farnsworth, and we were having a nice – he's a wonderful guy,
oh,
a very
yeah.
nice guy. And at one point somebody said – I'd like to blame you for this. I don't know who it was, but I'll say it was you – said, oh, Frank, look at that. And I looked over my shoulder, and there was a waitress – coming right at that moment with a full tray of beers. And when I turned, I didn't bump into her, but she saw me turning, and she swerved, and the entire tray smashes onto the ground. Every beer smashed into a million pieces. And I was apologizing profusely and all this. But the worst part was when we were leaving, Farnsworth slipped her a 20 and said, I'm sorry about that, dear.
No, that I said, forgot.
Oh, man. I felt so bad.
Well, it's so good to compare notes like this because I guess I do mythologize everything, the circumstances of our first meeting and all of that. And it's great to test these things against other people who were there. Ollie Johnston and Frank Thomas, meeting them was such a hoot, going out to Ollie Johnston's home. I did tell you the story, did I not, about the drawing of Mickey Mouse from Ollie?
No.
He had a wastebasket filled with drawings. As we were leaving, I sort of tentatively suggested, well, gee, since you're throwing those drawings away, Ollie, may I take one? And he immediately said, well, my hand has not been working well today. I'm having problems, and I threw those away because I don't like them. I'm so sorry. Would you mind maybe another time? And so I sheepishly slunk out the door, thoroughly ashamed of myself. But in 2 weeks, back in Kansas City, I had a package from him, a drawing of Mickey Mouse.
Wow.
With an inscription on it saying that, thank you for helping promote the book, which he and Frank had just written, The Illusion of Reality.
Mm-hmm.
And my hand is better today. I hope you'll recognize this person with whom we are associated.
Yeah, those were great guys to hang around with. I had a flip book that they had put out to publicize that book. And I had it with me when we went out to see him. I don't know why I had it with me in California, but I did. And so they both signed that flip book for me, and I have that. And then I ran into him a few more times. Howard Green, my friend who works at Disney, was really close with them. And so when he would have a birthday party or something, they would always be there, and they would always do some sort of specialty number or something. They were just great, great guys.
Showcasing people like that at our annual conferences, expos, whatever. And I don't know if we could say we had unveiled them, but we certainly were the first, I think, to show publicly Kevin Brownlow's Unknown Chaplain series. And, of course, Glenn MacWilliams, the cameraman for Fairbanks and for many other films, Jesse Matthews, Hitchcock, to meet with him and have him present to show Evergreen, which to me is one of the all-time Desert Island movies with Jesse Matthews, and to speak with him out at Santa Monica on a long, slow afternoon. I've got about 3 hours with him on tape, talking Fairbanks, among others. Where else could we have done something like that if not through the auspices of an organization like that? Now, what that meant to other people, I like to think it struck a chord with readers and attendees. But it was a bit unusual to have Ed Kimmer, Space Patrol, and to showcase him. At that time, you know, who had even seen any of the kinescopes of Space Patrol?
Yeah.
So, but I'm curious now to test your memory of some of the confrontations, acquaintances you struck up with some of your favorite film people during those years.
We ran into a lot of, I mean, that was the rich thing. I mean, I met Mary Bryan at one of those things. I met Hermes Pan,
right?
The choreographer for Fred Astaire. Didn't meet Lana Turner, but saw her. I remember at the banquet, that was the same banquet that Stephen Fetchett was at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good billing, Lana Turner and Stephen Fetchett. That's, and what I most remember about that is, and that was also the year that all the people from The Stuntman were there. So Richard Rush and Peter O'Toole and all those people were there too. And I remember that we were all seated in the auditorium at the banquet at the tables and all that and eating our dinner. And a good 20 minutes late, suddenly sweeping in this blonde Venus with her white gown on is Lana Turner. She actually swept into the auditorium and kind of walked through the audience toward her seat with her arms outstretched, like, I'm here, here I am.
That was thoroughly spontaneous, Frank. Yeah, there was nothing staged about that.
but I mean, you know, we met remarkable people. Lyle Wheeler and
Walter Plunkett.
And remember Sidney Gilleroff was hairstylist, but at his table was Esther Williams and Elizabeth Taylor and Betty Garrett, and I can't remember who else, but it was like this powerhouse table of actresses.
Well, of course, the whole ploy was to snag a really, really big name, like a Frank Capra or Comden and Green or something, but then find somebody who was so close and so friendly with them that an invitation from them to come and let him give them an award was really important. Like Comden and Green, Leonard Bernstein gave them the award. So you have to find these pairings to better ensure that the nominee, the award winner, will come. And so Francis Ford Coppola
talked to Gwen Verdon, gave a presentation to Gwen Verdon. And so that kind of pairing made everybody happy.
I was standing in the back of the room. Francis Coppola was late. And they actually got that man, Arthur, what's his name, who sang Pennies from Heaven.
The street singer.
Yeah. And he sang Pennies from Heaven for us because they were stretching, because Coppola had not gotten there yet. And I don't know who the woman was, because she didn't seem to be a normal film society person. I didn't know her. But she was, when Coppola came in, and I was standing by the door, so he comes in and he's standing right next to me.
I'll tell you who it was.
Okay. And this woman starts introducing, once she gets the signal that he's in the room, she says, you know, he's one of the great directors. He directed The Godfather. He directed The Connection. And I turned to him and I said, that's my favorite.
That was Eleanor Powell's secretary.
Really?
I can't remember her name. But, yeah, white-haired lady.
Yeah, but she clearly did not know the Coppola canon particularly well.
And do you remember why Coppola was late?
Well, they were filming Cotton Club.
Right. Do you remember why he was late, though?
I seem to remember that it had something to do with him cooking.
Yes. Excellent.
Spaghetti or something.
He had spilled spaghetti sauce all over the white suit he was wearing, so he had to go home and change. It was as simple as that. Then I think he spent the rest of the time up in the Film Society suite trying to romance Alan Miller.
Ah.
At least that's Alan's take.
Well.
Who could blame him?
I would not have hesitated to try to romance Alan myself.
Indeed.
What a dish she was.
I think Sasheen Littlefeather was up in that room either at that time or another one.
Wow.
Yeah, they all would kind of come out of the woodwork. You know, we'd establish our headquarters and people would start showing up. There'd be Buddy Ebsen somehow. Tony Randall in the elevator glowering at people with cigarettes. We smoked cigarettes in those days, Frank.
Well, some people did.
Well, I did.
No, I just, wow. I simply rode the white horse. That's all I did. I didn't smoke cigarettes. But, yeah, I remember so many encounters with people. There was also a Western Awards thing that I never went to for some reason.
Oh, you missed.
But I know there was some fun stuff. But one time I was walking across the lobby of the Sheraton Universal, and you were at a elevator. And you said, hey, Frank, we're going up to the suite. Come on. And I said, okay. So I get in the elevator. And there in the elevator with you is Doug McClure, Woody Strode, and...
Maybe Ben Johnson.
Ben Johnson. All of whom... Now, I'm 6'3", and I was looking up as at skyscrapers at all three of these guys. And...
Well, to have them all in one room, I have a great picture. The fourth, I think, was Yakima Canutt. I have a great picture of all of them. And gosh, we had Eddie Dean and Sunset Carson and Red Berry. And that was, those were very popular. The Western heroes, again, we have to keep remembering, these people had made films that were only just now becoming available again. Black Hawk and people like that, maybe you could find some of them. They weren't being shown on TV much anymore. Not in theaters. There were still some repertory houses, but those were mostly the A-list. And so it was really exciting to...
Sure.
And I'd like to think that for them, it was a lot of fun, too. Where else would they have all gathered like that? And just to sit back and let them talk. Just let them alone. Like we did with King Vidor that time.
Yeah.
When Kevin Brownlow was with us. I remember clearing out one of the rooms and making it incommunicado so that Kevin and King Vidor could have a lunch and Kevin could interview Vidor, because, and even Kevin at that time was being harassed and pummeled and pounded by fans. I mean, it was like he was a major movie star, too. That was so cool.
I think I talked with Kevin about this in his episode of the podcast, but that was the year we were, I think it was the Beverly Hilton, the banquet was. It was somewhere. It wasn't at the Sheraton Universal. It was somewhere else.
But we were at the Hilton several times.
Okay. Yeah. And Kevin and I were kind of attending it together. And so we were seated at the same table as King Vidor. And as it happened, and I was probably rude to do this because they had little placards to show us where to sit, and I was seated between King Vidor and Kevin. And so before the meal begins, Jane Withers gets up and says she wants to say grace before the meal and ask everyone to hold hands. And so I contend that I'm the only person in the history of the world who ever sat holding hands with King Vidor and Kevin Brownlow while Jane Withers prayed.
There it is, a moment.
But also, my other memory of that was a guy, Greg Evigan. He was an actor, and he was at a show called BJ and the Bear.
Right.
And he was at our table. And I just have this great memory of him saying to Kevin, "So, Kevin, what do you do?" And Kevin says, "I'm a writer." And he said, "Good, that's what this business needs, better writing." And then the same, that self-same Greg Evigan. And Greg, I have nothing against you if you're listening to this, and I'm sure he is. But he was introducing, Leatrice Joy, maybe?
Could have been.
And it was definitely a silent actress, no doubt about it. It was a silent era actress. And so he gets up and he says, "You know, I've often thought that if I were a leading man back in the 40s, there's no one I'd rather work with than Leatrice Joy." And I thought, yeah, I'm sure you've always thought that. I'm sure that's always been, he had no idea who she was.
I remember being at a table with Lee Steiner, Max's widow, mm-hmm. and Jimmy Stewart and his wife, and Jim Dark at the Brigham Young Archives, which now has the Steiner papers. Just sitting there thinking, is this happening? And other moments where you wish it weren't happening.
Oh, yeah.
Ida Lupino out on stage with a scarf tied around her head, pulling out from her coat a picture of Howard Duff and proceeding to just tear into him. Heaven knows, had they just been divorced? I don't know. And she went on and on. She was alone on stage. We tried to have the orchestra strike up a few notes as a cue to get her off, and we could not figure out how to get her off stage. And I'm finally backstage at a stairwell overlooking the street, thinking maybe I could just jump now and end it all. To this day, I'm not sure how we got her off stage. I think one of our people just walked out and escorted her off. But there was a pathetic moment in a way. But, oh, my gosh, it was a nightmare that remains vivid in my mind today.
Well, there were a few of those people who got up there and just wouldn't stop talking. I remember Gail Sondergaard was one. Just kept going and going and going. And then you and I were discussing this yesterday. Margaret Hamilton was supposed to give an award to Mildred Natwick and clearly forgot once she was out there why she was there. And started talking about her career, and finally, after what seemed to be 7 hours, maybe 4 days, I don't remember how long she talked, but a guy, I thought he did it very diplomatically. He walked out, and I don't remember who it was, but he walked out and he said, "Yes, Miss Hamilton, you've had a wonderful career, and and now we're here to honor your friend, Mildred Natwick," you know. And so. And Margaret Hamilton was going like, "What? Huh?" So it was very sad, and I'm sad to say funny at the same time. But.
And how else would we have met Diana Sarah Carey and talked about the Hollywood Posse? The book had just come out. And oh, gosh, Margaret O'Brien. I fell in love with Margaret O'Brien all over again. She was everything I might have hoped for a child star many decades removed. Quite wonderful. The book people, we had Richard Kozarski come out because he had just written his book about von Stroheim and gave him an award for that. And Kevin's book, War of the West and the Wilderness, was the occasion for getting him out there. And William K. Everson, the idea that we could also honor the historians
And the archivist was maybe something kind of new to an award ceremony like that. I kind of think so.
Yeah.
But I was very proud of those aspects of things, too. And Kevin wrote a very nice introduction to one of the American Classic Screen books that we published a couple of years ago. And in the introduction, he kind of validates what we were doing. And Kevin won't be inclined to just glad hand like that.
No.
It was really nice to see somebody of that stature acknowledge that, you know, maybe these guys had been doing something okay after all. And it lives on in the memory. And that's nice. It's nice to know that the Academy has materials, the run of the magazines and things like that. I wonder how many people out there might have ever heard of American Classic Screen. Because it ended about 84, 85.
Yeah. It's really too bad because it was a good magazine, and the National Film Society, I think it got a certain amount of suspicion from Los Angeles movie people because it seemed like these out-of-towners coming in, and I heard a lot of people giving that sort of, who do they think they are? Why?
Right.
But in fact, in terms of the people that were seen there and people who were at the banquets and all that, it was really terrific.
I think the very fact that we were outsiders like that, and moreover, Hicks, they're from the sticks in the Midwest, Hicks, Nicks, Sticks. I actually think that worked to our advantage more often than not. I know we did several television promotions with the news programs in Los Angeles, and that was always the thing that came up. How does it happen? And the whole Wizard of Oz analogy kept coming up, and that never hurt either. Yeah. So I've often found in many of my own books that sometimes being a relative outsider to whatever discipline is involved can be a help. Someday maybe we'll talk about my work with Antonin Dvorak, and being an outsider in the community of Dvorak scholars was really an advantage.
Huh.
And I think the same thing was true with the Film Society. We never really got too highfalutin, I hope.
I don't think so.
That's a Midwestern term, Frank.
I understand that. I'll look it up later.
Yeah.
The one thing that always bothered me about the National Film Society was when it came to the banquet things.
Oh, we hated them.
They always turned it over to other people.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was such a mistake. There would be all these, they look like soap opera stars or something.
And they were hired musicians.
Yeah.
There was a guy with a banjo once.
Oh, I remember at one of them, Miklos Rosa was sitting at the table next to me. And this guy, he was a soap opera guy, and I don't know who he was. But he was being the MC. And not a very amusing MC. And he was about to talk about music, and he said, you know, I'm quite a fine musician myself, and I'm going to play for you one of my masterworks right now. And I turned to somebody, I think it was Stan Singer next to me, and said, he's going to play Chopsticks. And he sits down and starts playing Chopsticks. And I looked over, and Miklos Rosa had this look of disgust on his face, like I've never seen any human.
I remember visiting with Miklos Rosa, and I think it was maybe at his home. But this is where my memory fails me. I can't remember the exact circumstances. You were not there by chance,
no,
huh?
No.
Were you there with us when we went to Pickfair?
No, I was not.
With Valerie Sorrell?
No.
And Buddy Rogers at Pickfair in 1976. Now, hey, it was still Pickfair.
Yeah, and Mary was still there.
And Mary was still there, and I'll never forget Buddy saying, would you like to meet Mary?
Wow.
Hello. Really? And he said, just a moment. And he went upstairs and then came back down, said, come along. And all I did was stand in the doorway and kind of in the dim light. It was very staged. She was in bed with a comforter and sitting upright against a bunch of pillows. And I said hello, and she said hello, and Buddy said, he's from the University of Kansas, Mary. You know, that's where I went to school. And that was that.
Wow.
And it was, what, 1979, I think, that she died.
Yeah.
to have been at Pickfair, to have seen everything as it originally was, the paintings, the Remington bar downstairs, all of that, wow. And a lot of the Fairbanks
mementos were down there, a sword, as I recall, stuff like that.
Yeah, when we interviewed Buddy Rogers for the Wellman documentary, Wild Bill, he was already living in the lodge, which was next door to the Pick Fair. And from what I could see of Pick Fair, there was not much left. This would have been in 95, I guess.
Yeah.
So I don't think there was much left of the original Pick Fair.
Got a Gene Herschold Award, and so I remember coming out, and Stan and I got a crew together. And we photographed Buddy. He was still pretty sharp at this point, so this must have been about 78 or so. And he played lots of musical instruments for us. We went out onto the balcony, and then we went through some of the rooms. And I have all that on videotape, which reminds me of something. We do have a fairly good amount of videotape of some of those awards presentations.
Really? I'd be interested in seeing
and
some
you,
of that stuff.
You were in one of them, and I remember sending it to you. You were being interviewed, which I know was a wonderful experience for you at the time.
That what you sent me was when the time we did it in New York, and my Wellman book had just come out, so this would be 83. And there was it a nostalgia channel or something like that?
There was a nostalgia channel, and I have no idea how long it existed, but at least they were there. At least we weren't very good about keeping filmic records of stuff.
But this guy was interviewing me, and he's incredibly unfocused, and he keeps forgetting where he is and asks me the same thing again and again. And but I get to see myself at 30 years old. So
a handsome rascal, Frank. What happened?
Are you telling me? Come on.
And then Miles Kruger dusted off some of those amazing films that he has kept over the years of Broadway luminaries that were shot on the sly by someone, I forget whom.
I ran the projector for a presentation of those one time for Miles, and it went for hours, it seemed to me. But those are, for people who don't know about these, and I don't know what the status of them is, but there was this guy in the 30s and 40s, maybe even into the 50s, I don't remember, who would take his 16 millimeter movie camera into the Broadway theaters. Mm-hmm. And
silent.
Yeah, silent. And he would take footage. He would usually wait for a pretty loud musical number or something so that the whirring of the camera wouldn't bother people. So it tends to be fairly big numbers. But he's got, you know, scenes from Pal Joey with Gene Kelly, and he's got George M. Cohan.
And Fred and Adele, maybe?
Well, that's the sad story that Miles would often tell, and when I have Miles on this, he'll probably tell it again. But he had footage of Fred and Adele Astaire, and as far as we know, there is no footage of Fred and Adele Astaire. But this guy had it, and when Miles was in the Army, he met a guy who was a huge Fred Astaire fan, and Miles gave him the film. It said,
good heavens.
Here's something that you would like. And
I'm not sure I ever heard that story.
Yeah, that's the story that Miles told me. And so it's gone. It's just, I mean, who knows? It's just gone.
I'm wondering if maybe I should back up a little bit and explain that there was this thing called the National Film Society, which was headquartered in Kansas City. Began around 1975-76, lasted up to about 1984-85. And yes, there was a magazine called American Classic Screen that I edited. And Frank was one of a number of people who, under whatever circumstances, swam into our orbit, along with Stan Singer and DeWitt Bodine and Herman Weinberg,
mm-hmm,
and Jim Welsh, of course. I'm trying to think of some of the other writers, maybe luminaries like that that actually wrote for the magazine.
Did Kevin ever write anything for the magazine?
I interviewed him for the magazine, and I interviewed Everson for the magazine. But no, they never actually wrote for it. But Weinberg did, and of course he had all these great photographs,
sure,
in his archive. I remember sitting with Herman. I think it was a room in the Coliseum in New York City. And I got a sense of what life can be like for somebody whose career bloomed and
Then the sun set on it, to mix my metaphors, because he was in a little room. He was serving me orange juice. He was talking about the old days. And I thought, well, here's a guy who in many ways really pioneered a lot of more popular film writing at that time, made films himself, was an acknowledged authority on Lubitsch, Sternberg, and people like that.
Sure.
And wasn't anybody paying attention to him anymore? That's scary. We forget so quickly. And so maybe something like the Film Society and the magazine planted its flag for just a little while and said, we not only remember, but we appreciate.
You know? Well, my favorite Herman Weinberg thing as relates to American classic screen was the time he was writing about the people at the conventions, the people who came to the conventions, and referred to them as gum-chewing yahoos.
Well, there was that. There was a family. They all dressed in identical Czech patterned clothes, something straight out of Harold Diddlebach. And they lived in a van. It wasn't down by the river, but they lived in a van.
I have vague memories of these
people. Yeah, and they came every year, and they were wonderful people, but they were exactly what Herman was describing. And then, you know, we did have that, I hate to call it a lunatic fringe, but there were people there who just lived and died with their idols. And clearly they had crossed the border between the illusion and reality. And who could criticize that, really? Because that's what the films can do. That's the magic of the motion picture. But I always would kind of draw back from that a little bit, because there had been so many fan magazines and things like that that just exploited that kind of thing to the max. Even the Jeanette MacDonald fan club people.
Oh, yeah.
I went up to Topeka to interview them because I wanted to do a feature on Jeanette MacDonald for the American Classic Screen. And there were these two middle-aged ladies who were absolutely devoted to Jeanette MacDonald and would haul out the defenses of anybody who dared demean her, impugn her, her husband, Gene Raymond.
Raymond, yeah.
Yeah. They were militant about it in her defense. They would have these week-long events back in Hollywood every year. And again, two people from Topeka, and there I am from Kansas City, meeting with them so that we could talk about what's going on in Hollywood. And they had, I remember going to a graveside ceremony with them for both Jeanette, it was always first name, Jeanette and Gene Raymond. They would have screenings and meetings, and I have no idea if it's still happening, but these were the dyed-in-the-wool fans, and sometimes, it did get a little weird.
The first time I ever came out to Los Angeles was in 1979, and we toured some of the cemeteries. It's the only time I've ever done that. And went into the place where Jeanette MacDonald lay, and continues to lie. And there was a woman sitting on a bench right in front of the crypt, weeping. And I thought, wow, this is 1979.
Yeah,
woman is sitting here weeping. So
now, I've got to tell you, Frank, as you well know, this sort of fringe element is not confined to Hollywood nostalgia.
Oh, no.
I've gone to some music festivals in Germany in my work on Robert Schumann. And let me tell you, I think the same people who came to our conventions somehow migrated over to Germany to attend these music festivals, because they had the same kind of adoring, unflinching, unabashed worship of this composer that some of our listeners may not have ever heard of. So I think you find anybody, if it's a dog, if it's a person, if it's a stunt person, you will find a coterie of people who think that they are keeping the flame, and bless their hearts. In many respects, maybe they are.
I guess. Yeah, I was asked to give a talk, and what turned out to be, I think, about 2 days after 9/11, there was this conference in San Diego. It's a very bleak time to go and talk about movie stuff. But somebody asked me to talk about the process that I used in researching my books. And the title I came up with was Libraries and Loonies, because I found in almost any subject, you can find one person who has an entire basement filled with material about that subject.
Or maybe a whole shelf of every language translation of Bogest.
Yeah. But I would not know where to find a person like that. But then that person would have serious problems. But
well, allow me to interject at this point that it's one of the things that's always fascinated about you, me, about you, is the degree, the almost obsessive degree to which you can go to your favorite subjects. And the Lost remake of Bogest is a classic example. And yet, you remain eminently sane. And you have objectivity.
Well, that's your opinion.
Well, after all these years, but you have maintained a certain degree of objectivity, along with the enthusiastic, almost obsessive attention for detail. That's kind of rare. In this business, we've met a lot of people who cross that line. And it's really too bad, because unless you can pair up both of those energies, the obsessiveness and yet the objectivity and integrity, you're going to be lost.
Yeah.
And I think people who listen to your podcasts have already gotten that sense out of you and the people that you interview, that it's, and I'm saying this, that you're kind of a unique character in this scene to be able to sustain both sides of that aisle as well as you do. It's quite amazing. And I wish I knew more people like that in the other fields that I'm very interested in, you know, music especially. That line gets crossed way too often. And when that happens, then the knowledge, the respect for the character, the idea that you don't have to worship somebody to find them eminently worth knowing and learning about, that there can be feet of clay, but so what?
Yeah.
They don't have to be saints to be respectable and admirable and all of that. Anyway, that degree of balance that you maintain, I'm going to even throw in a highfalutin term.
Oh.
E.T.A. Hoffman called it Besonnenheit. That balance that you've kept between the dream and the reality. It's pretty interesting. Now, I'm curious, have you ever thought yourself about, have you ever looked into yourself as you've gone headlong, bar the expense, bar the inconvenience to pursue a topic, but yet at the same time thinking, but yeah, but also, I'm an historian, I can maintain objectivity. Or do you ever wonder if maybe you're losing that?
No, I never think that I'm losing the objectivity, because I'm not the sort of person who, you know, I'm not going to start dressing up like Bogest or anything. You know, I'm not going to start doing those kinds of weird things, become a historical transvestite, as we say.
What an interesting term.
And I don't know what that is. I remember the first time I ever met Kevin Brownlow. I think I might have, I'm sorry if I'm chewing my cabbage twice. I might have talked with him about this. I probably did. But that was a year ago. So.
Yeah.
I had written to him because I just started deciding to do a book on Wellman. So I just decided that that would be something that I should do. And I don't know why I thought I should, but I thought I should. And it occurred to me, since Kevin had, and I was naive about it, just in my 20s, and I didn't know much about how to do this sort of thing. So I wrote to Kevin, and I said, listen, if you would be willing to share any of the interview with Wellman that you didn't use in your book, I would appreciate it, or I'd just love to hear it, even if I don't use it. And never heard from him.
That's unusual.
It is unusual. And so the next year, I met him at the National Film Society thing. And so we spent a lot of time together over the course of that time. You and me and him would go places and do things. And so I got to know him pretty well. And I didn't bring it up because I didn't want to be, hey, I asked you for something and you didn't give it to me. So the day that he was leaving for the airport, we were standing waiting for his cab or whatever. And he said, you know, I feel really guilty about something.
Wow.
And I said, what? He said, well, you wrote and asked me for these interviews, and I never replied. And I said, oh, well, you know, it's your interviews. And he said, no, that's not it. He said, I thought that if you heard them, you would think Wellman was so crazy that you wouldn't want to continue the book. And And I said, well, I appreciate that, but I don't care how crazy. That's not my... Yeah. I don't have a vision of him that I want him to live up to. I want to find out what he was and what he was like. Yeah. So I think that has a lot to do with the way I approach everything. It doesn't matter to me. You know, in all the time I've spent studying the Alamo, people get really nuts about that thing and nuts about this basic question, how did Davy Crockett die?
Yeah.
People get really crazy about it. And the fact is that we have no idea and we'll never have any idea. There are some people who say this, some people who say that. Nothing you could take into a court of law. Nothing. And so the idea, the people who get so insanely upset about a subject like that means that they've constructed an image and all they want to do is support that image. And so the only knowledge they'll let in is the knowledge that will support what they already believe.
It's a narrow cast view. And this is what is most scary, that single-minded quest, interest, obsession, then blocks out everything else. And I think one of these this podcast thing is really good for those people who think they know you. You know, you're the Beaugest guy, or you're the Titanic guy, the Alamo guy. Hopefully, this is giving people a chance to know that you also know a heck of a lot about Charles Ives. I mean, I remember the day that came up, and I was astounded. That a person...
That never comes up in this podcast.
Well, it should. We don't want to be... just like a movie actor, we don't want to be labeled, identified as just one typed thing. And all too often we encounter that. And in the film community that I deal with in academia at the University of Kansas, how I wish I could find more people who, like you, would not only love and pursue film, but also the theater, music, literature, dance. What am I leaving out, for heaven's sake? They all need to go together, and I think anybody who's truly fascinated by any one of those is automatically going to be spinning out into the others as well. That, to me, is the mark of a real enthusiast / sometimes scholar, don't you think?
Well, yeah.
As much as you love William Wellman, nobody would want to think that's it for Frank.
No.
And it's not.
Although it is. No. I love all sorts of things. And when I list... The enthusiasms that I have, or I used to have a thing on my website called My Pantheon, which I would try to write essays about the things that really meant a lot to me of the artist. And they're all over the map. I mean,
we are so alike.
Yeah.
In that respect. It doesn't mean the same things, although sometimes that's there, but we're so alike in this weird disparity.
Yeah.
Although I love to pursue the through lines. In my case, you know, what do you make of somebody who has spent a whole lifetime reading, watching, learning about James M. Barrie, G.K. Chesterton, Douglas Fairbanks, Robert Schumann, some of the great illustrators like Everett Shin from the Ashcan School?
Sure.
I mean, what do all these people mean? There is a through line that, whether we're aware of it or not, is there.
I guess there is.
There doesn't even have to be, but it just kind of seems like there's a commonality there, like Casaubon and Middlemarch is that key to all mythologies, you know.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder if that's the case. That, I mean, as we talked about the other day, it's... For some of the things, it's very easy. I mean, the Alamo, the Titanic, Custer's Last Stand, right. Even Beaugest, they all have a certain last stand quality. There's something about that. But that's not, you know, you would be surprised to learn that the last stands are not something that obsess me. I mean, the notion of it. Mm-hmm. So there's something else going on in all those things.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure why that is, Claire always says that all my favorite movies are ones in which everybody dies at the end. You know?
And all my favorite movies is when somebody flies.
We'll see there
before
you
the end.
Yeah,
that's my thing.
But but you know there is a certain element of that because I love history and I love any movie that can portray history with at least the ambiance of reality. I don't require that something be completely historically accurate because that's impossible for
a movie. But maybe a certain graphic vividness.
Yeah.
Even if their history's wrong, what emerges is something that no other medium has been able to capture.
Yeah.
You know?
And just last night, we're recording this on July 5th, 2013, for those of you in the future. And last night we went over to our friends Tobin and Jana's and watched Yankee Doodle Dandy in their big screen out in the backyard. And it was a wonderful experience. But that film, in addition to just being wonderful in the ways that you think it is, I mean, because great songs and, you know, this powerhouse performance by Cagney and all that stuff, it's also incredibly respectful toward the period it depicts. And that is not always the case in Hollywood movies. Just to take another Cagney film, Man of a Thousand Faces, has no verisimilitude at all. None.
I can't even bear to watch.
Yeah. It's, and then you look at, for some reason, the 50s and the 60s seemed to be the worst when it came to depicting the past. I was watching not too long ago that Carol Baker version of Harlow, and it's, you know, women with bouffant hair and all this. It there's nothing about the 20s or 30s to this film at all. Nothing.
It may tell you a lot about the time period in which the film was made.
Sure.
Which may have a value, but yeah.
Well, that's what I always say when I give talks about history and film. I would say that's one of the great valuable things about movies is that every single movie ever made, I believe, is, aside from what it should be about or what it's trying to be about, is also about its time and place.
It's a kind of a stereoscopic view that we have.
Yeah, and it's, so you look at Bonnie and Clyde, and it did a fairly reasonable depiction of the 30s, but it's really more about the 60s than the 30s. Yeah. And there's just no way around that. It's about 1967. It's not about 1933.
All of the multiple worlds encapsulated in a film. Recently, I was looking at The Exile, 1946, mm-hmm. Max Ophuls, with Doug Fairbanks Jr. as Charles II. Okay. Well, how many ways can you look at that film? Fairbanks' first film after the war. So that's one thing. Okay. The fact that he decides to make an action swashbuckler film indicates an allegiance to his father, perhaps a commercial realization that to keep his career going, he may have to go that direction again. Max Ophuls, emigre director in Hollywood, trying to get a foothold. Had he not made that film with Fairbanks, he may not have stayed in Hollywood to make the other films. So you've got that. Then you've got the Hollywood studio system versus Max Ophuls' own idiosyncratic way of handling sets and camera, which emerges very strongly in this film. What am I leaving out? Oh, the historical aspect. Charles
sure.
II. Who was he? What was that all about? What was you know? Then you got Henry Danielle, one of the great villains, who puts in an appearance. There's an action scene on a windmill that's wonderful with Ophuls' swooping camera. By the time you're done considering all of that, you've got a movie for all seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the best movies are movies for all seasons. And I have a hunch that many of your own favorite movies have that same kind of multi-layered, multi-textured fascination, interest, and significance.
Yeah.
Which makes them, well, like last night, looking at Yankee Doodle Dandy again, I was just savoring the recreations of the stage techniques,
mm-hmm.
the stagecraft that went on. And the movie, for the most part, is fairly cleaves fairly closely
yeah.
to what a theatrical production would have looked like with all of its blatant artificialness and all of that.
Yeah.
That part of the film, I think, isn't discussed nearly enough, but it was what held me for the umpteenth viewing.
Yeah. It seems realistic, which is a different thing than being real, but it seems realistic. And even the way the music is orchestrated and everything seems pretty, a little bit, aimed toward the 40s.
Somebody did their legwork in that thing. And then you've got Robert Buckner. Now, there's a character to deal with.
Yeah.
A communist. No question about it. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, he even did that film about Chopin.
Yeah.
A Song to Remember. How does that ideology feed into the film, if it does at all? And then what happened to Buckner?
Yeah.
And as an educational pursuit, films are wonderful if students are just willing to stretch a little bit and consider all these different contexts, as opposed to, the movie star.
Yeah.
You know, films are just entertainment. It's a popcorn thing.
Well, it's
fine.
Yeah. But,
there's so much more to it.
I get so much out of looking behind the action in films, and especially in silent films.
Well, talking to Bengtson.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, John Bengtson is one of my heroes. He astonishes me every time I turn around. And as a matter of fact, the most recent thing, I don't know if you saw this on his website, just genius guy. He found in Keaton's Cops, you know, the scene where the anarchist throws the bomb onto the wagon and Keaton lights his cigarette with it in Cops.
Yeah, I love that.
Because John Bengtson was looking at the Blu-ray and got more detail than he had ever seen before. He realized that the anarchist is on the top of Busso and Frank, and that in the distance you can see the Egyptian being built. And there it is. He's got a frame grab, and there it is.
Yeah.
The Egyptian under construction right across the street. And
that's
just like a one-second thing in the film, but that's history in addition to whatever else.
And he keeps widening our view. He gives us a CinemaScope image of a Academy aspect ratio film. For example, he came out to the Buster Keaton Festival in Iola, Kansas, now in its 21st year.
Wow.
And what he would do is that he would take a frame of a Keaton film, and then he would literally show us what's beyond the edge. What's to the right? What's to the left? What was the rest of that shot? If we could have had a super widescreen image, what else would be there? And I love that. To me, that's almost like magic. That's going back into the past and almost, what's the word? It's like a time machine, because he shows us stuff that we didn't know, but is there, that was there.
Yeah.
I find that, for reasons I find difficult to explain, obviously, I find that very magical.
Me too. And as a matter of fact, I'm hoping to see John when I'm in San Francisco for the Silent Film Festival. And I want to talk to him about these Harold Lloyd films that were just on TCM that were all 1917, 18 vintage, all the B.B. Daniels ones that I'd never seen before. And there's all sorts of great location stuff in there, and I'm really curious as to where it all was and everything. But that stuff I get lost in, and I can't understand. It always puzzles me why other people don't get lost in that stuff. Like last night, when we were at Tobin and Janice, we watched this, he showed a short, a Leon Errol short, a 1935 short from about 1935 or 36.
In Technicolor.
In beautiful Technicolor. I mean, in Technicolor in which they went out of their way to make
Warner's Vitaphone.
Yeah. And, but you look at those cars. You had these beautiful 1935 brand new paint jobs. I mean, right out of the factory looking cars.
The gas station pumps.
Yeah. And just all that stuff. In addition to the many, many, many cute girls dancing around.
You didn't notice that part.
But just looking at the fixtures and that sort of thing, you know, when I was a kid, I loved my grandmother. I had a very close relationship with my grandmother, who told me ghost stories. And that's, I think, the source of my love of ghost stories. But she would often start telling me a story about her childhood, and she would give me details about what things were like and how they did things and what and how they acted. And I was always fascinated by the difference. It's like, you know, the past, as we have been told, is a foreign country. And mm-hmm. we look at the past in the same way that we look at a foreign country. It has two equal things of interest. How are they like us and how are they not like us?
Well, and looking at Leon Errol, for me, was how the past is not like us.
Yeah.
Because that's the fascination of looking at people like Leon Errol. Why?
Yeah.
How did that happen? He was popular? Really? And so instead of denigrating it or attacking it or criticizing it, instead saying, how could that happen? What does that tell me about audiences, about the modes of entertainment that they were used to?
Sure.
How he had come up through the ranks to become a movie star, which seems so unlikely when you think about it. That aspect of the past is so neat.
Yeah.
When you don't just find what you want to find. And you don't just find things that you will like, but you find things that puzzle you. The past is a very mysterious place. And looking at that film was a very mysterious thing for me. Those gas pumps, Leon Errol, the girls in their costumes, this dream vision of a super gas station mm-hmm. that the movie is showing us. That's what people were thinking, watching, enjoying at that time, but it's very mysterious to me. Really? Yeah. You know?
And it is interesting to look at. I mean, obviously Leon Errol was playing a guy who thought he was funnier than anybody else thought he was. So in a way, his bad jokes played into his character. Mm. But.
Well, you could look at it that way.
Yeah, but there is, you know, there are modes of humor that are specific to the moment. And then there are kinds of humor that are universal and will never leave us. You know, you look at something like Laugh-In, which was very topical and skewed directly to what was happening at the moment. It's an invaluable time capsule. Not often very funny. Now. Yeah,
and illusions long since lost to us, like in the film last night.
Nevertheless, it's still, I mean, that's what makes it a great historical piece.
But Frank, I have seen darn few historical recreations on film that were strange, that gave us that ultimate sense that the past is really weird from our point of view. We just don't really understand it anymore. It is odd. And I love that, but I just don't see that happening often enough.
I think
the French can do it.
The only time you see it happening is, I think we have this 20-year window in which everything changes from being current to being embarrassing to being historic or to being genuinely antique or whatever. Right now, it is in vogue to mock the 80s. 10 years ago, it was in vogue to mock the 70s. You know, it's just basically the 20-year period or 25-year period from which you can look back and say, wow, is that really what people wore their hair like and everything?
And if you were there at the time. This to me.
This is what it looked like. I mean, that's just what it was like. You
maybe
know?
It's because as I grow older, I question it more. But we had an interesting exchange about the Lone Ranger. Okay, you will not see it. I saw it. Okay, I saw the Pirates of the Caribbean films, which I hated. All of these mind-bending blockbuster tentpole films that are coming out in droves, the superheroes, and all of that. I continually have to test myself. This is a fact. They're out there. This means something. There are negative aspects of this. I don't know if there are positive aspects of this, but in another 20 years, what will people be making of this, despite what I think now? And so it's like a challenge to myself sometimes. Go ahead and see the damn thing and try and figure out if I possibly can what it means for today and what it might mean for tomorrow. Now, you may think that's a futile ambition, and certainly it means I will waste a lot of time looking at films like The Lone Ranger. But maybe it's because as an educator, I feel some ill-begotten responsibility to see what the kids are seeing.
Well, and you
are... nothing can brand a teacher more than to be somebody who just turns up his nose at what they are watching.
Well, sure.
You know?
And you also have to live in your own time. You become like these gum-chewing yahoos of which Weinberg spoke, who glom onto some idealized past and stay there. But we have to live when we live. And I don't denigrate current films. I like them or I don't like them.
Yeah.
But I try to see them as they are. And so... as much as, you know, I find myself having to defend myself quite a bit from people who say, oh, well, you're just interested in silent films or you're just interested in films from the 30s or whatever. But, yeah, that's not the case in any way. I like movies. And I will enjoy some of the tentpole films. I rarely find one that really sticks with me for it in any emotional way.
Every one of the Pirates of the Caribbean films I had come out of going, what did I just see? Let me try and reprise what was happening there. I can't. Now, is that me? Is there a chaotic sensibility, a collage kind of culture that's emerging here? Well, there is, as a matter of fact. And if I'm not relating to it, what does that mean? Should I try? Is it a waste of time? Or if I am trying to relate to it, am I just justifying the time spent in the theaters that I'll never get back?
I think if I can make a generalization about those films, and that's always a dangerous thing to do, but I find that they're mostly about sensation, that they're mostly, to use the cliche, like a ride at Disneyland.
Cinema attractions, yeah.
And so, in a way, it's like character and plot and those things take a real back seat to just visual and oral stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what they're about. What I get a little sad about is that the structure of these things seems to be identical from film to film. That it starts in a certain way, it goes to a certain act two, that it goes to an incredibly explosive act three, and they all seem to be built in the same form.
And superheroes are pummeling and pounding each other, and they can't die. So what's the point? They just go on and on, but nobody gets hurt, nobody dies, so there's no consequences to anything. But again, what does that mean?
And what, you know...
sometimes I just want to go home and say the hell with those things. I'm sticking to my guns. I don't enjoy this. You know.
Yeah, I just, you know, I don't want to give up the chance that I will discover something that does mean something to me. And sometimes it happens. I remember watching the first Iron Man, which I thought was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and maybe we can talk about it now or later, but even films, for the most part, that I really like or really enjoy while I'm watching them, I rarely feel the need to watch them twice. Then there are movies like Yankee Doodle Dandy last night, which I must have seen 20 times in my life or more. I've seen The Wild Bunch probably 50 times. Singing in the Rain, gosh, who knows how many times I've seen that film. And I'd watch any of those today if you decided to watch. So what is that?
Well, are those in any way comparable to the early books of Edgar Rice Burroughs in that the authorial signature of those films is hard to find? The story seems to be telling itself. And a lot of smarter literary people than me point to Burroughs's gifts as those of the bricoleur. You know, it's just the story that counts. There's no finessing about it. There's no embellishment. There's whatever is there is simply there. It becomes like a mythic structure. And some films, I think, they just cruise along as if I have to remember there's a cameraman there, there's a sound man there, there's Curtiz calling the shots. But what emerges on the screen is some magical thing. Robert Altman told me once that when he was a little boy in Kansas City, he loved movies because they just seemed to have appeared on the screen. They dropped out of the sky. Nobody made them. They were just there. And as a result, you live with them, like you live with your environment, the atmosphere, your family. The fact that the more that an authorial signature is intruded upon the material maybe kind of lessens their ability to live with us generation after generation after generation. I don't know. Now, Wells, we can live, talk about an authorial signature. We can live with him. But Michael Curtiz, try and find an authorial signature from everything he did.
Yeah, you can't, and no. Yet try to find a bad movie that he made.
I know.
And it's rare.
So maybe there is this gift of the NAIF, that N-A-I-F, who just services the story, services the image on the screen, and lets it be. Let it be itself. Oh, I always turn to Schumann for analogies because so much of his music, people fuss over the interpretations and on and on, and more than one really great pianist has told me, just play what's on the score.
Mm-hmm.
Just play it. Don't fuss with it. Just trust that what's there is enough. And I think in lots of films we have found that ability to just trust what's there. I feel so good watching things like Yankee Doodle Dandy. It's just there, you know. I don't have to worry, unless I'm an educator. I don't have to worry about James Wong Howe's cinematography and all that. It's gorgeous, and I can go there. But in general, year after year after year, it's just a comfortable fact of my life that I live with.
But that's my life. Yeah, that's the thing that is puzzling to me, because why can I watch something like that again and again and always either re-enjoy the parts that I like or in some cases discover things that I for some reason hadn't noticed before, but always finding something in there that makes me want to sit through it. And there are many movies like that in my life. Umbrellas of Cherbourg, as I could watch it every day, I think, and it's just...
And listen to it.
Yeah. Oh, boy. And, oh, we could hear the clicking of tiny paws on the... for the listener, Maggie is joining us for this portion of the interview.
Well, not being really a dog person, I've always noticed when I visit how Maggie the dog, or your other dogs, they enter a room and the temperature changes, the room changes.
Yep.
There's a sea change of some kind. They do, talk about an authorial signature.
Yep.
They lend it to a room, which must be part of the attraction of having a pet.
I like to think of Maggie as an auteur.
I love it.
but it's a question that I go over a lot because, I wonder, in a film such as Iron Man, which I liked, or the first Spider-Man, which I thought was a good film with good characters and a logic to it, and I liked it. But I don't need to see either one of them again. And I wonder if in films today made for basically a teenage audience, is that everything in the film is made so explicit that there is no real treasure to be mined from going from going back to it.
Yeah.
Whereas The Wild Bunch, which to me is, if not the best film ever made, in the top 1.5 best films ever made, there's always depth of character. Leaving aside the brilliant set pieces that begin, middle, and end that film, it's all about the people and about the way they react to each other. And yeah, you can watch the entire film simply looking at the way people look at each other.
You're describing the first Thin Man film.
Yeah.
That, to me, is a desert island film. I've shown it to classes. I never tire of it. And I treasure the moments where they just kind of go off the tracks.
Yeah.
He's going to shoot at the baubles on the Christmas tree.
Yep.
They're going to line up shot glasses. That gets into why I like Renoir so much.
Oh, me too.
Those directors who just allow a film to kind of have a pulse, to breathe, to not force everything, to allow the accidental, the fortuitous things to happen. Like a snapshot as opposed to a posed photograph.
Yeah.
And don't we really prefer snapshots? Because there's a sense of the accidental going on.
You know, I think the first time I saw Rules of the Game, I must have been...
Well, that's the greatest film ever made.
Yeah, I believe it might be. I mean, it's certainly way, way, way up there. And I don't think it much sank into me the first time I saw it, which I must have been around 20 or 21, something like that. And it just seemed that not much had happened. I mean, not much went on.
Yeah.
And then when I saw it again, it was like a slap in the face. Then I thought, wow. And now I think just in terms of direction, which is a term that I think people misunderstand a lot, because I think people always look at direction when they mean photography or cinematography, or they mean editing. But directing, where people are in the frame, what people are doing when they're in the frame, gestures that people are making, looks that people do, that's directing. And in those terms, that might be the most beautifully directed movie ever made, because everybody is always precisely where they need to be.
Like a dance.
Exactly like a dance, except it always looks completely casual and spontaneous. It looks completely effortless, and yet it's perfect. Every single frame of that film is just perfect.
Renoir does this all the time. I love his Day in the Country.
Oh, man, yeah.
Where two of the characters will be standing above a little stream, and suddenly the camera will just move down, look at the screen, move back up.
Yep.
Hello. or you'll maybe it's Renoir himself. He's in the little tavern, and he'll open up the window, and there's the girl on the swing in the distance.
Yeah.
Now, is that an authorial intrusion, or is it simply allowing the surfaces of that, the reality of that film to seep through? That's a great dilemma, I think, because it was his decision to open the damn window.
Yeah.
But yet it was natural that it would be opened.
But I think it's that kind of what we might think of as serendipity that is not present in so many films. It's not the blockbuster films.
No.
Because those are not a subtle form. And I guess it's not even fair to hope that they would be. They are what they are. They're explosions. They're explosions of color and sound. And it's just...
But it was Tobey Maguire's moments, his nuances, his uncertainties, his hesitations in that first film that I remember.
Yeah.
Except for The Flying. Of course, sure. I always remember The Flying.
And the same in Iron Man. If it weren't for the character of Robert Downey Jr. and the performance that he gave, which was a genuine human who found himself in this incredible circumstance, that gave that film the heart that it needed to exist as a real story.
And by contrast, did you see Three?
No, I have not seen Three.
Can I talk about it for a
second? Sure.
Because, okay, you've got Iron Man in his suit. Now you have Iron Man's girlfriend in her suit. Now you have a whole bunch of other suits. By the time the movie is ending, you've got a screen filled with flying metal suits, which completely cancels out our interest in any one of them.
Yeah.
More is better?
It's just, yeah, it's bigger, bigger, bigger. That's all.
But then I draw back and say, well, now, what does this mean that the filmmakers would resort to this? Let's do cookie cutter suits. So there's no individuality anymore.
But
I'm stuck. I didn't like it, but I still wonder why.
But that is not to say that movies aren't being made today that I don't want to watch again. Just recently, Moonrise Kingdom was on TV and on Showtime or something, and my wife Claire said, "Oh, I think you'd like this. You should watch this." So I did. I had meant to watch it anyway, and it somehow just slipped past me. And so sat down and watched it. And the second that it was over, I got up, went to the computer, mm-hmm. and ordered the Blu-ray. Because I thought, I just want this in my house.
And
I just
interestingly enough, it's a film in which the director exercises total control.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a frame, a moment, a camera move in that. And so what do we make of that? Here I am preaching the authorial intervention. Let's abolish it and let things happen. Well,
no, not in that film. No. Completely, yeah. It's totally stylized, but filled with invention and wit and unexpected things. And I think more important, filled with good people. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Good music.
Yeah, really good music. And just if it only had the scene of them in the church performing Noise Flood by Benjamin Britten, that would be enough. Yeah. They could have about 2 hours of that and I'd watch it.
Hats off to somebody who could bring that into a commercial.
Absolutely,
arena.
Yeah.
Wow.
True, yeah.
How did that happen?
I love that movie. And, you know, I feel... I was talking with, I guess it was with Jim Curtis in the last episode of the podcast, and we were talking about cynicism, and I don't like cynicism, and I think that is a hallmark of, I don't like people who are cynics. And when a film comes along that has an open heart, as it were, that's really attractive to me. And I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you probably have not. There's a comedy series that was on HBO couple of years ago called Bored to Death with Zach Galifianakis and Ted Danson's in it. And but it's this really quirky little comedy about a writer, Jonathan Schwartzman, and a writer who wants to be a detective. And he's not a very good one, of course. But what I like about the show is that it's just about these good-hearted people and people who, these three misfit guys who get together to do these things, but always kind of look on the bright side of whatever happens. And I find that so attractive in a way because there is so much, that is the opposite of that in popular culture now. And not that there are examples of those things that I don't enjoy. I mean, I love The Walking Dead. I love Dexter. And there are several shows like that that are about the seamy side of life that I thoroughly enjoy. But give me a moment of somebody just being open to the world. And you know, it's nice.
And let there be people out there who pause to say, John, I saw this great movie the other day, or this great book, or I heard this music the other day. Check it out. You know how often that happens with me? Never.
Wow.
And I feel like it's my duty, always, to bore people to death by saying, you should check this out. Or I've actually encountered hostility from some students when I suggest that maybe, along with Lyle Lovett, they might also enjoy, you know, songs by Schubert. You'd think that I had critique Lyle Lovett, which I had not in any way. I like Lyle Lovett. Why not expand?
Sure.
There's so much good-hearted stuff out there, and whether it's National Film Society or Cinecon or some of these, when you get right down to it, it's a community of souls, I think, hopefully generally, who like to share things.
Yeah.
And man, that's great when you can learn, when you've encountered stuff you'd not expected.
Yeah.
It's like going to a movie that you had no clue what it was about, and yet, my goodness, what's that?
That's always the best way to go.
That's the best.
Yep. Speaking of going, we need to go.
Yep.
And I will ask you.
Have we made broadcast history yet?
We have made broadcast history. Okay. As a matter of fact, I'm waiting for a call from the Broadcast Museum because I think we might be getting some sort of medal. I will ask you to come back next week, and we will continue this. On another day.
We talked about our faves, you know.
We got lots more to talk about.
I've got lots of them, and so do you.
So we'll be back next week, and see you then. I hope you enjoyed that talk with John Tibbetts, and remember, we'll be back next week with another one. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, go to thecommentarytrack.com, and you will see on his guest page links to many of his books. I couldn't list all of them. There's just too many. I'd spend the rest of my life just creating links for John's books, but I put a bunch of them up there. So if you're interested in a lot of these books, and I can't see why in the world you wouldn't be, because they're terrific, I would highly suggest you go to the Amazon links, click on them, and that way I get a little bit of a kickback, which is more than John ever gave me. And you also have the three volumes of American Classic Screen article reprints, and I would highly recommend those. Not only will you find the very earliest of my publications, and that should give you a laugh. There's also some other great stuff. Kevin Brownlow wrote the foreword to one of them. Many great writers and film historians wrote articles for that magazine. I really enjoyed that when it was up and running, and so this is your chance to get a lot of that stuff without finding long dead back issues of the magazine itself. So I highly recommend that. I want to thank my wife, Claire McCullough, for being my wonderful announcer. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my theme music for and aft. And I want to thank James Hutchins, who designed both of my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. When you go to thecommentarytrack.com, if you're not ordering books by John Tibbetts, I hope that you will order a DVD of the Lost remake of Beaugest. It's something I put my heart and soul into, and I think that you will enjoy it, and so I hope that you will go there. Just go to the video page, and you'll see it right there, and it'll take you right to PayPal, and it's so easy. It's a mere $20. Postage is free. How can you beat that? And you'll laugh, you'll cry. It's a whole emotional thing. So I hope you'll do that, and I hope that you will join me again next week when I continue my conversation with my pal John Tibbetts. And until then, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.